Welcome to episode 13 of the Marion Vermeijzen podcast. I'm Marion Vermeijzen. Creating this podcast has reminded me of what amazing and interesting friends I have. Linda Curry and I have been friends for 35 years. Linda recently retired from a career as an executive in the high-tech industry. Most recently, she was a senior manager for QuickBooks Quality Assurance at Intuit. Prior to working at Intuit, Linda's career included positions as Vice President of Engineering Services at WebGain, Director of Quality Assurance at Remedy, Director of Database Quality Assurance at Borland, and Senior Manager of Mac System Software at Apple. Last year, she moved to Reno, and she now lives right around the corner from me. She describes herself as happily retired from the software world and enjoying relaxation with family, friends, books, gardening, and remodeling, and all things that we like to do in our free time. She is a wife, mother, and grandmother, and I am honored to call her my friend. Thank you so much, Linda, for doing this. This is so much fun. We've been friends for a long time, and I'm excited about doing this. So I know you're retired, but tell me a little bit about your career, and how do you describe your career when people ask what you did?
Well, my career was sort of the biggest surprise in my entire life. You know, I grew up in the 50s and 60s, and all the women that I knew stayed home. It was sort of like a Leave It to Beaver kind of community. And, you know, if you'd asked me what I was going to be doing as a grown-up, I would have thought I'd just be raising lovely children and running the AAUW or the League of Women Voters, but never that I would be working in high tech.
We started out working together, and then, so how did that all happen?
Well, it was all just, you know, luck. Ray and I got married and moved to California, and after I got the house settled and the boys into school, I looked around to see who I could be friends with, and it turned out everybody in my neighborhood worked. So I thought, I should get a job. And I had met you by then, and we were over for dinner at your house one night, and I mentioned that I was going to look for a job, and you said, oh, you should apply at my company. We're looking for people everywhere. So I thought, well, okay, you know, I sort of have a very small work experience, and none of it, I'd never really used a real computer. But I thought, well, maybe I could be like a secretary or something. So I went in for an interview, and unknown to me, your company had decided that they were having trouble finding people to do the lowest level of coding. That they were going to give sort of a math aptitude test to everyone who came in, no matter what position they were applying for. And if they scored well, they would offer them a job as what was called a fixed video display coder. So I, who had a minor in math in college, took the test, and it was sort of like the math part of the SATs, and I aced it, and they called me that night and offered me a job as a coder. And I said, oh my gosh, Bray, they've offered me a job as a coder, like working on a computer. What do you think? I don't think I can do this. And Ray said, you can do this.
Oh, that's so great.
You know, you're a smart, capable woman, and I know how to do this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
If you have trouble, I'll help you. You should take it. I think you'd love it. And that's how it started.
Oh, that's one of my favorite stories. I just love it. So then you got into quality assurance, right? So how did you transition from, you know, coding into eventually QA?
Right. Well, as it turned out, I'm sort of an obsessive perfectionist, and so as I was working on the coding part, I got a reputation for being really good at desk checking my work. And simultaneously, that company decided that they needed to set up a department that was doing verification and validation of the software, making sure that it met the spec and it met the customer's needs. And part of the software that I was working on was sort of how you generate a medical record number, how you figure out, you know, is a bed empty, clean, and in a room with someone who's of the proper gender for the person you're trying to admit. So they asked me to come in and help this other group figure out how to test my software. And the more time I spent in that group, the more I liked it. I mean, this was just the perfect match for my personality type. I love puzzles. I love things being correct. I'm confident about my own opinion, so that if I say something's wrong and the programmer pushes back saying, no, that's how I meant it to work, I'm confident enough of, say, well, wait a minute.
Well, so then when you went to Apple, you were in a quality assurance group?
Yes. So when that company closed and I was looking for another job, I decided to look for jobs in testing. Mm-hmm. They didn't really have much quality assurance back then. What they mostly had was just testing and you reported bugs.
Right.
So quality assurance is sort of the next step up.
Oh, okay.
Where you actually figure out what would a shippable product look like, and then report metrics on how you're doing toward reaching that goal.
So it's not just
testing. So testing is just a part of it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So then when did you get into management?
Well, so at Apple, when I went to work there in 83, the only product line they had was the Apple II.
Right.
And they were doing most of their testing with outside contractors. So I was hired to write test plans and hire contractors and then, you know, manage their work.
Right.
And as networking started to become part of the product line with servers and things like that, they realized that you couldn't just ship a single system with a printer off to a contractor and have them do the work.
Right.
We needed to hire people in-house to do this.
Yeah.
And so the company was growing so rapidly that unless you just said, I will never manage, if you make me manage, I'll quit, you became a manager. So that's how it happened.
And the rest is history.
And the rest is history. And, you know, I just kept working my way up until, you know, at one point I got to be a vice president of engineering, which was just totally amazing.
Well, what was the most interesting company you think you ever worked for?
Well, I think probably Apple was the most interesting place I worked for. I went to work there in January of 83 and worked there until 1990.
Oh, wow.
And I am never going to be the person who comes up with the next idea for something like they're doing nowadays with iPhones and iPods and, you know, that kind of thing. But what I'm really good at is project planning.
Right, right.
You know, somebody has to be able to say at some point, that's a perfectly wonderful idea, but, you know, we just cannot get it into this release. And, you know, if we try to do it, here's what's going to happen.
Right, somebody has to be the voice of reality.
And since I'm kind of a statistics wonk, you know, it was a good match where I felt like I helped them get products out, good products out on time.
Right.
And then there's just nothing like working with this what you think are the smartest people in the industry, which is what I thought at that time.
Well, I think the whole computer industry at that point, I mean, you think about we were part of the creation of a whole new world. You know?
Oh, I know. I'll never forget. So, you know, when we worked at Spectrum Medical, it was all computers that were off in a, you know, off in a room, and you put your batch order in, and eventually you got something back.
Right.
I had never used a PC before.
Right, well, they weren't around,
When I showed up for work, there on my desk were a bunch of boxes, and they said, okay, you know, now that you've had your day of orientation, the next thing to do is put your computer together. So I put the computer together, and then the next thing I needed to do was take all those floppy disks and copy them.
Right.
So I had this dual disk drive, and you'd put, you know, the master in one and the blank disk in the other one.
Right.
And it started, you know, the lights came on, reading, writing, reading, writing. I thought, I'm not a love at first sight kind of person, but it was just love at first sight.
Absolutely, absolutely. Oh, that's so cool. So what part of your, is that the part of your career you're most proud of, do you think?
No, actually, you know, I think the part of it that I'm probably most proud of is that I just did it.
Right, absolutely.
You know, this was, I mean, part of it is my personality type. At Apple, they spent a lot of time helping build people's soft skills, thinking that, you know, no matter how brilliant you are technically, if you can't work with other people, then you're never going to be a success. Mm-hmm. And so I know that my personality type sort of drives me toward that. If you've ever taken a Myers-Briggs,
right.
There's this personality type that's a extra ENTJ. Mm-hmm. I'm an extrovert. I'm intuitive, which means, you know, I think I know the right thing to do right now. Since I'm extroverted, I'm going to tell you all about it. You know, I think more than feel.
Right.
And I'm more judging, mm-hmm, you know. Mm-hmm. So that personality type, the small synopsis is natural leader, mm-hmm, which is very flattering and perhaps, you know, a little bit true. The other side of it is often more confident than circumstances would warrant. And so I think, you know, because Ray, who I truly love and admire, uh-huh, thought I could do this, and I have a personality type that leads me to think, oh, well, why not?
Right. Yeah. Uh-huh. Exactly.
Yeah, that was good. But actually, the best part about my career, I think, were all the great people that I, mm-hmm, hired and mentored. When I went to work at Borland as the director of quality assurance for their database products,
right.
I was told that everybody in the QA group was just a total loser and needed to be fired.
Oh, my goodness.
And, you know, the truth of the matter was, they had just been improperly managed and improperly used, moving from product to product at the very tail end of development. And, you know, without exception, they were all really valuable people who needed somebody to protect them and give them time to do their job and promote them, you know,
absolutely,
to, instead of saying, well, you know, I did this, say,
yes,
Rick did this,
right,
Mike did that.
Yeah.
You know, these are serious bugs. These need to be fixed.
Yeah. Be an advocate for them.
Yeah, because I think, you know, at the bottom line, everybody wants to wake up every day looking forward to going to work.
Absolutely.
And it's not always going to be fun, and it's not always going to be easy. And at the bottom, kind of at the, I don't know, at the level of your bone marrow, you need to know every day that what you do is worthwhile.
Absolutely.
And that you yourself are appreciated for doing it.
Absolutely.
And so I think that developing that kind of an environment, especially at a place where the people in the beginning are not appreciated, mm-hmm, and they don't think what they're doing, mm-hmm, is worthwhile, I think that's the thing I'm most proud of.
Oh, absolutely. I think, well, and you're good at it too. People like to work with you. So are you in contact with people for most of the companies you worked at?
I am. It's been such a nice surprise that people who worked for me wanted to stay in touch with me, which is a nice thing.
Oh, that's very cool.
Yeah.
Well, you said you studied math in college. What else? That was your minor, you said.
Right.
What was your major?
Political science.
Oh, that's so cool.
You know, because I'd always thought, well, you know.
Yeah, run for office.
League of Women Voters.
Right.
You know. Yeah, but back in the 60s, so Sputnik had happened toward the end of the 50s.
Right.
And the federal government decided that America had fallen behind
in science.
Yeah. Yes, much like now. And that one way they could jumpstart a generation of scientists, mm-hmm, would be to offer what they called National Defense Education Act scholarships.
Right.
So I had a full scholarship to University of Puget Sound, uh-huh, and then I had an NDEA loan that paid for my room and board and books and things like that.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And that required that I have at least a minor, uh-huh, in science or math.
Yeah, well, I guess it paid off in your sense, didn't it?
It did. Who'd have thought?
Yeah. Well, besides the math and your background, do you think there are other things that prepared you for your career?
I'm not so sure about preparing me for my career, but I think the thing that helped me get started was, uh-huh, actually my husband.
Uh-huh.
You know, I've said this before, and it's just so true, that I would never have known what I could do with my life if it hadn't been for Ray.
Yeah, you think about how important having somebody.
You know, you're smart, you're capable, you can do this.
Right.
I believe in you.
That's so cool.
It is so cool.
So how long have you been retired?
Wow, 3.5 years? That doesn't seem possible, but it has to be.
So how was the transition from work to retirement? What helps to make it a successful transition?
Well, funny you should ask. So I actually tried retiring once before.
Uh-huh.
I was working at Remedy, a company I can name because it's sort of no longer Remedy. And I just hated it. You know, I talked earlier about wanting to wake up every day looking forward to going to work because you think that what you do is worthwhile and you're appreciated for doing it. At Remedy, none of that.
Wow.
You got to the point where none of it was true.
Right, right.
And I was thinking about, well, then what else would I like to do? And I actually couldn't think of anything else that I'd like to do. And grandchildren had started to come along, and I thought, you know, looking at our finances.
Right.
Ray and I talked about it. I said, you know, you don't really have to work at all if you don't want to.
Right.
We've always lived very frugally, thinking that we should never commit to more than we could support on one salary.
Mm-hmm.
So I retired, and it lasted for 6 months. After 6 months, a former boss of mine called up. I was up on Orcas Island hiking with the grandkids.
Right.
And he said, what are you doing? Have you ever thought about going back to work? And I realized that whatever Earl was proposing, if he had said, I'm opening a restaurant, do you want to come be the hostess? I would have said, I'm so there.
And it wasn't, I mean, obviously it was partly because of him, but a lot of it was because you just wanted to go.
I was just so ready.
Right, right.
Yep. So to make it a successful transition the second time, I spent some time thinking about why had it not been successful.
Right.
And I realized that my career was such an important part of who I am.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is true for a lot of us.
Right, right.
Sort of the what you do and who you are.
Absolutely.
End up being completely twinned.
Yep.
And so what made it successful the second time was counseling.
Ah, so you what know, kind of counseling?
I spent about 6 months going once a week to a woman in Mountain View to work through, you know, why had it been so hard the first time and, well, you know, how was I going to make it work the second time and...
So what did you do differently the second time then, to, besides the counseling? I mean, were there little things you did then? Or do you think it's just more of a personal thing? That?
Well, I think it was more a personal thing of, you know, I sort of grew up kind of before the days of Dr. Spock and, you know, that the most important thing is to make your child know it's loved.
Right.
And my parents are, I have a wonderful relationship with them now, but they were very young and had
And you're the oldest, too.
I'm the oldest.
Right.
And they were really determined to raise a perfect child.
Uh-huh.
And I am a completely imperfect person. I'm self-determined, I'm willful, I have strong opinions, and even when I was 3 years old, I was perfectly happy to share them with anybody. And, you know, the sort of realization that just because you haven't felt loved enough doesn't mean you're not lovable.
Right.
You know, that kind of thing, that you are a person of value other than what your job
so
is.
So it was really, it was, in retiring, it was partly just figuring out
That
you didn't need the job
I don't need the job to be a person of value.
Yeah.
And, you know, you think about the people in my life who I admire and respect, who admire and respect me back.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've had a really serious health thing going on recently, and it just reinforced that I have this army of people out there
who
truly love me. And
Right.
You know, I think that I wouldn't have been as open to understanding that.
Yeah.
Or even accepting it if it hadn't been for this counseling.
Yeah. Very interesting. Well, how has retirement been different than you expected?
Well, so it's interesting. I'm way more busy than I ever thought I'd be. I think retirement, you know, I'll just have day after day with nothing to do. Ha, ha, ha.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah. And also, it's much harder to meet people.
Oh, because you work, know, that's where you
the
meet them.
The combination of moving and retiring. Yes, you know, it's just like when you're in college, you meet people. When you're working, you meet people.
Right.
Almost all of my friends have come either from my work or Ray's work.
Right, exactly.
And, it's hard. Yeah,
absolutely. Well, what advice do you give to people who are looking forward to retirement?
I think the best piece of advice would be to have a lot of short-term goals. So for instance, when Ray and I retired,
right,
we sold our house in Sunnyvale, California,
right,
and moved to our vacation place,
right,
with a goal of fixing it up,
uh-huh,
and selling it, because
right,
we knew we did not want to be retired. You know, Forest Hill is a beautiful little town,
right,
but it's nearly 20 miles from Auburn,
right,
which is a very small town.
You didn't want to live out in the country,
you
basically.
You can't be, you know,
yeah,
90 years old and having to drive over a mountain road to get a prescription filled or see the doctor.
Yeah,
so,
yeah,
you know. And so I think that having a lot of short-term goals with a time limit on,
uh-huh,
them that you need to achieve is really important. Otherwise, for myself, I could just end up staying home every day, reading and playing games on the computer, and
isn't that interesting?
You know, gardening,
yeah,
and Ray and I are a pretty self-contained unit,
right? Right.
And but I don't want to end up like a little hermit.
Well, so what advice do you give young people who about planning for retirement? You know, especially even our kids or people that are a ways away from it. You know.
Hmm. Yeah, I thought about this a little bit. I mean, the best piece of advice would be save your money.
Isn't that the truth?
You know, when I look at the statistics on how many people in their 50s have saved like less than $10,000 for retirement.
Yeah, it's scary.
It's just sort of scary. You know, Ray and I always had a goal of living on one salary.
Yep.
And it's not that we saved the other one, because we certainly spent a lot of money traveling and on technical toys and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But I think it would be really scary.
Oh.
You know, for so many of us, it just seemed like the bubble would never burst.
Yes.
You'd look at your house value,
yep,
and you think, oh my gosh, this house that I bought for, you know, $250,000 is now worth $1 million. Well, you know, nowadays it's probably worth more like what you paid for it to begin with.
So true.
So save your money.
That is so true. So how long have you been in Reno now? You moved here, what, about a year ago?
Yeah, almost a year and a half.
Okay. And how has Reno been different than you expected?
Well, I think the biggest thing, I'm an avid gardener.
Uh-huh.
You really only have a 4-month growing season,
wow,
here in Reno. Average last frost is toward the end of May.
Uh-huh.
Average first frost is early October.
Wow.
So, and the soil here is so poor. You know, in California, you just would sort of stick it in the ground and Mother Nature would take care
right,
of it.
Right.
Here, the ground has practically no organic matter. The air is dry. There's no rainfall.
Right.
It's just, you know, so there's been that. The other kind of happy surprise was, it freezes in the winter here,
yes,
which means for someone like me who has seasonal allergies,
right,
I have this wonderful period from like December until April where there's no pollen, it's so dry, there's no mold.
Wow.
It's covered with snow, so there's no dust. I'm just a happy camper all winter long.
I love it. Well, so one of the things about moving is that you do leave behind many of your friends. Do you have a approach or how to build and nurture new friendships?
Oof. Well, you just have to get out there and make it happen.
Yeah.
And be prepared to, you know, there's a saying about dating that you have to kiss a lot of frogs before you find your prince. I think this is not the kissing part, but you have to sort of extend a branch of friendship to an awful lot of people, and just be prepared for the fact that you are not going to like all of them,
right?
And the ones that you do like, they're not always going to click with you,
right?
And
right,
you just,
and they're not always receptive. I mean, they're not always in the position that they're looking for new friends, even
right,
if they might be good friends.
Yeah, yeah, that's
good,
true,
point,
too. I always figure they just don't like me, but whatever. So it helps to be in a place like Reno where there's so much going on.
Yes.
You know, it is the only metropolitan center in northern Nevada.
Right.
There's Las Vegas in the south, us in the north. So it has, you know, a major university, opera, symphony.
Yep.
Air
yeah,
races,
true,
balloon races, jazz festivals. There's a newcomers club. The library has a group. I joined the Master Gardener training. You just have to get out there and, you know, participate in things that you like doing.
Almost like making it a job, I guess, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, kind of make it your job. I've had to do this once before when I moved overseas and didn't really know anybody. And just getting out there and making it happen is the only key I have.
That makes sense. Well, you alluded to the health problems. I know you've got the recent diagnosis of breast cancer. So what have you learned from that experience that might help other people in that situation?
Well, yeah. So dealing with a serious medical situation is really stressful and time-consuming. And it's not like having bronchitis, no, where you kind of recognize, oh, I've had this before.
Right.
I'll go to the doctor, I'll get antibiotics, and, you know.
Or I'll just leave it alone and it'll get better.
Yeah, 4 days, I'll be better. It's not only stressful and time-consuming, part of the stress comes from the fact that it's largely out of your control.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there's a lack of knowledge, a lack of experience. I've never had anything this serious before.
Right, right.
I should have taken a class in anatomy or physiology or something. I don't even know how my body works.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
You know, so you have to just find medical people that you trust and let them take care of you and make your own focus be on taking care of yourself.
Right.
It's not easy. You know, I'm
typical
type A personality.
Right, you want to be in control.
Absolutely. I remember going into my friend Mike's office one time, and he had this little sign that said, "For peace of mind, resign as general manager of the universe." And I thought, oh my God, if there were a job like that, I'd be right there at the top of the line applying for it. But with this kind of thing, you just can't, you know. I'd have to go to medical school. You know, there's just, so you just have to trust that these people that are taking care of you know what they're doing.
Now, the prognosis is good, right?
It is good. My oncologist says that I could be a poster girl for why you need to get an annual mammogram.
Yes.
So my mother had breast cancer back in the 60s.
Right.
So I've been quite religious about getting it every year.
Mm-hmm.
And last year, nothing showed up.
Right.
And this year, you know, I got it done, and they called me back and said, we need access to last year's mammogram, which was done on the other side of the hill. And okay, so I filled out all the paperwork for that. Then they called back and said, there's some differences between last year and this. We want more films. So I went in and did that. And all along I'm thinking, I've always had what are called calcifications.
Right.
And so this has happened to me before when I've changed doctors, where they've said, we need you to come back.
Right.
This is all old hat. Then they called and said, we need to schedule you for a biopsy.
Ooh.
Oh my God. But I still thought, this will be nothing.
Right.
And they couldn't, they tried doing what's called a needle biopsy and couldn't do it. I'm not quite sure why, but it didn't work. And I thought, they'll say, well, come back in 6 months and we'll, you know, do another mammogram. Instead, they said, we need to schedule you for surgical biopsies.
Oh.
And that was back in May, and it's just been, you know, the start of this whole thing. So that came back with cancer.
Oh.
But as it turned out in the biopsy, you know, they rate cancers by what stage you're at, which has to do with how big is the cancer and how many places is it located.
Right.
So I was stage one,
right,
which meant that
it was
very small and only in one place. The other thing that they measure is the grade, which has to do with how aggressive is it.
Okay.
And it goes from 1 to 3, where 1 is very slow and 3 is very... And mine was a grade 2, which means it's a fairly fast growing.
Ooh.
So if I hadn't made time in April to get the mammogram, and then in May to schedule all these tests.
Yes.
Including my first biopsy was on my birthday, because that was the first day they had available. But, you know, I was just driven.
Right.
He says that, you know, it would not have been such a good prognosis if it had even been 3 months later.
Because I would think there's a real temptation to just, ignore it and it'll go away. And I mean, you know, intellectually, you know that's wrong.
Right, that's wrong, but yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, so this has to have been terribly emotionally. I can't even imagine how difficult it's been emotionally. What's really helped you deal with it?
Wow. Well, you know, my husband, my friends.
Right.
Reno has a really good Institute for Cancer, a renowned hospital, and they have people there who do counseling. They have a service called Healing Touch that sort of helps your body get into balance, which in the beginning I thought was just sort of like voodoo magic, but it actually has seemed to work.
Oh, that's so cool.
Interesting, the internet has been a big help.
Really?
Because there are so many websites. There's one called Army of Women.
Oh, right.
There's
right.
the National Cancer Institute.
Right, right.
All these different websites. There are group community forums for women who've been through cancer.
So to educate yourself.
Right, to educate myself and to verify that the good news my doctors were giving me, you know, actually
they weren't just making
it up.
Do you think doctors treat you differently because they think, because you people are more able to educate themselves than they used to be, or is it?
That's a good question. You know, I'm sure that doctors make an effort to treat everybody the same. I have had two of my doctors tell me that it's really nice to have somebody interested in where the data comes from. So it was interesting with the oncologist, because breast cancer has been so well funded through things like the Susan B. Komen Foundation. There's a national database that has been tracking people with women with cancer, with breast cancer, for decades.
Wow.
To the point where they have so much data in it that my oncologist could go to a website, type in my age, my general health, which is good, my stage of cancer, my grade of cancer, was it estrogen receptor positive or not?
Right.
And get a printout that says, okay, out of 100 women your age and generally good health with stage 1, grade 2, estrogen receptor positive breast cancer, if you have surgery alone, here are the statistics for having a a reoccurrence. If you have surgery plus radiation, here are the statistics. So you have surgery plus radiation plus an estrogen blocker. So it really helps make the decision easy. And since I'm a, you know, I love relational databases. When I first worked on a relational database, I thought, oh my God, I want query by example for my life, you know.
Isn't that the truth?
So he said I was the first person who had ever asked about, you know, how did they get the information in? How did they pull it out? You know, are there enough people in the database that meet my criteria that it's actually a statistically significant sample size? He'd never had anybody ask him those questions.
Oh, that's so interesting.
He's young, and so he's grown up in an age of computers.
Right, so they just take it for granted. Oh, that's so cool. That's very cool. Well, so you lived in, you've lived overseas in a couple different places. I know, when did you live in Iran?
I lived in Iran from 1972 through 75. So this was all before the revolution and, you know, this is during the time when the Shah was.
And what did you like about living there?
Well, I think the best thing about it was that everything is different. You know, I grew up in California in a little town where it's all sort of college educated. It's a bedroom community for people that work in the city or Oakland. And you sort of grow up, it was mostly white. We had one Japanese family when I was in school. His family owned the local plant nursery. And that was about as exotic as it got, you know. When you go live somewhere else where everything's different, it's just exciting. You know, seasonal, food's only available seasonally. So in the winter, your vegetables are carrots and cabbage and the winter squashes, and that's it. No matter if you were willing to pay for it, you could not get strawberries in February. There's nothing like Whole Foods. The language was different. They used the metric system. Traffic was different. Tehran has had 6 million people then. I think it's more like 12 million now.
That's an enormous city, isn't
it? It's huge. I had never lived anywhere like that.
I didn't realize it was that big. I mean,
You know, the traffic. The other thing that I liked about it was the history.
Oh, it's been there so
When I went over there in 72, they still had the facilities down in southern Iran, down by Shiraz at Persepolis. They had had a big celebration of 2,500 years of continuous government.
Wow.
I came back in November of 75, and in 76, we had our bicentennial,
yes,
200 years of continuous government.
They got, what, 12 times
I mean, it's just, you know, you go visit a town, and they'll show you, here are the ruins from when Genghis Khan came through, and here's graffiti left by Alexander's troops, and it was just amazing.
The cradle of civilization, really and truly. Well, how do you think your experience of living in Iran changes your perspective now about the crisis and the concerns about Iran and nuclear weapons and everything? Or does it?
I think that, you know, there's always this business of there's the people who live in a country versus the people who govern it.
Right.
And one of the problems I am not less concerned about, their, like their development of nuclear weapons, because the country, even when I was there, was so polarized.
Really?
They have a very small section, very small population of people who have a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
They send their children to Europe or America for their college and postgraduate education. And they come back and they live in their own little group. The vast majority of people there are very provincial. You know, they live in their own little town. They don't travel much. They're educated at local schools that are often run by the imam or the people at the mosque. It has a very religious bent. And, you know, if it's just like my experience of going to Iran, where all of a sudden I realized that my place in the world was completely different than I thought it was in Lafayette, California, Washington, that, you know, in huge parts of it, I'm a minority, and other people think completely differently than I do about things that I thought would be obvious. They get all of their information from trusted local authorities, and they believe it.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense.
You know, just like, you know,
like even here.
Even here, you tend, I mean, you know, you look at the political ads, and you know that there are people who look at those ads, and there'll be someone like me who looks at an ad and says, what the heck, that can't be true. And other people go, oh, well, I, you know, oh my goodness.
That's so true. Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm quite worried.
Wow. Well, are there things about Iran that you think most Americans don't realize?
Well, I think that the fact that the people are just so wonderful, and the food is so wonderful, and the history, and, you know, when I went over there, I took medical supplies. I took aspirin and all this kind of stuff, and then, you know, it turns out I'm in this completely cosmopolitan town where everything in the universe is available.
Wow, interesting. Yeah,
but I think that the fact that their exposure to the outside world is so limited, we think, I mean, we have the freedom here in the U.S. to access any information that's available anywhere.
Right, right.
You know, we can look at a newspaper from China or Croatia, or we can have Facebook friends from all over the world.
Right.
Their television, their radio, their internet access is monitored and controlled. And it's just hard to understand how different that makes your life.
Yeah, I can see that. Absolutely. Have you ever worn a burqa?
No, no. You know, a burqa is that thing that comes all the way down over your entire body with a little window. In Iran, they wore what's called a chador, which is more like a floor-length shawl. You put it over your head and kind of hold
covers
it.
Covers your hair.
Covers your hair, covers your clothes. But your face is open.
Okay. Did you wear one of you? Is it a chador?
It's called a chador. No, I only wore it. I went on a trip to a couple of the religious sites, and you had to wear one in order to go inside the mosque as a sign of respect. But, you know, I'm a very conservative dresser anyway.
Right, right.
And even when I was in Saudi Arabia, where they were quite strict about it, you know, you wear a scarf and a long sleeve shirt and baggy pants and socks on your feet, and I never had any trouble.
Okay. How long were you in Saudi Arabia?
I was there twice on business. A company that I worked for had contracts to develop medical information systems at hospitals over there. So I was there In Jeddah, which is on the Red Sea.
Okay.
Once for 3 months and once for 2 months.
Did you? How was it different, or how did you like living there?
Oh God, no. to be polite about it, not so much. You know, in Iran, women are. I mean, they're definitely sort of patronized a bit, but you can drive a car. You can take a taxi. You're really free to move about as long as you don't do something that's, you know, against their customs.
Right.
You have a lot of freedom. In Saudi Arabia, not only do their own women wear those burqas, there's religious police who sort of patrol what's going on. Not only could I not drive in Saudi Arabia,
right.
I could not be in a car with a man who wasn't my husband or brother or father.
Goodness.
So this meant that I couldn't even take a taxi. So the first time I was there, I spent the whole time in a hotel, and a bus line ran in front of the hotel. So if I wanted to go downtown, I could just get in the women's section at the back of the bus and go downtown. But the second time I was there, I lived in company housing. In a little complex outside of town with no bus service. And I couldn't go to the grocery store by myself. I had to wait until some other couple was going to the store and then ask for a ride with them. I found the whole thing to just be so, I don't know, humiliating is probably the right word for it. Yeah. The only... This is going to sound terrible to anybody who's from Saudi Arabia, but the only really wonderful thing about it was it's right on the Red Sea.
Yes.
And so almost every weekend, a bunch of us would go over there with snorkeling gear. And we had a swimming pool at the complex. We tried out scuba gear. And we'd go over there and go snorkeling and scuba diving in the Red Sea. It was just spectacular. I had never done that before. I hadn't been to Hawaii yet at that time. And it was, you know, like clamshells the size of, I don't know, the size of like... a small drum. I mean, they were enormous. They were, yes, clamshells 2 feet
real
tall.
Warm.
It's very warm. Yeah,
that
and clear because there's hardly any industry.
Wow.
Yeah, it was great.
Well, I wonder if Iran has become more like Saudi Arabia now, you suppose?
Yeah, I think it has. You know, you read books like reading Lolita in Tehran. And it sounds like it's still a very circumscribed life.
So tell me a little bit about the Master Gardener Program.
So the Master Gardener Program is run through the University of Nevada at Reno.
Yes.
And it's part of the Agricultural Extension Program.
Okay.
So they offer training. You apply to belong to it. And then they offer you free training. So I'm going down to Carson City Monday and Tuesday mornings every week for 3 hours a day. At the end of it, you take an exam, and then you're qualified to be a master gardener, at which point, to continue in the program, you have to give a certain number of volunteer hours of community service, and you also have to take, I think it's 30 hours a year of continuing education. So I think this is just a perfect match for a whole bunch of my goals. I'm finding gardening here very difficult. Normal soil has at least 5% organic matter. Here it's less than 1%. You know, most places get more than 7 to 9 inches of rain a year. Here, that's, you know, we're lucky if we get 9. So I will learn myself how to garden here. I'm going to meet people who have interests similar to my own. I'm going to be spending time answering the phone and taking care of people that walk in. Saying, hey, I just moved here and I'm having trouble. Everything I plant dies. I've lived here 25 years. Look at what's happening to my trees. Can you help me?
Right, right.
So this should be both scary and fun.
That's very cool. Well, so what is that the kind of volunteering you'll probably do mainly is like that? Or what other kind of volunteering will you do to, as you said, you have to do a certain amount?
Right. So there's all kinds of things. There are schools in Reno that have school gardens. Mm-hmm. There are community gardens that need people to help them. The Arboretum at up by the University of Nevada. Right. It has Friends of the Arboretum that do volunteer.
Oh, so there's a lot of different
places. Lot of different things.
Oh, that's very cool.
I could organize cleanup down at the Truckee River or participate in it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, okay. There's all kinds of things to do.
Well, so what are some of the most interesting things you've learned in your first few lessons? Because you've just started, right? This is a few weeks into it.
Right. So although I've been gardening forever, like I said earlier, you know, in California, you just sort of put it in the ground and that's the end of it. It's just, you know, your problem is that it grows so fast you have to keep pruning it. I think the most interesting thing was that the good soil. I'd never really thought about how is soil made up.
Right.
It turns out that there's about 5% organic matter in really good soil, and the rest, the other 95%, is water,
really?
Air, sand, silt, clay. You know, I always thought of soil as being mostly organic matter.
Right.
Turns out, wrong.
So even good soil.
Even good soil has 5%.
5%, interesting.
Yeah.
Well, so you would think that, so you just add 5% and you've got good soil. That's not the case?
Well, you think about what it would mean to add 5%.
Oh,
I mean, how deep do you go? If you wanted to have the top 3 feet of your backyard be wonderful, loamy soil.
Yes.
That's a
long way down.
That's a zillion cubic yards of
a lot of rocks
stuff, and a lot of rocks to go through. So soil has, you have your lovely loamy soil on the top, your topsoil, and then there's the subsoil, which has very little organic matter, and then below that you have all the stuff that's going to become subsoil. You have the bigger rocks.
Right.
So it gets worse the further down you go.
Oh, really?
And you kind of see it when you dig a hole.
Yep.
Like when Duke was doing your side yard, you could see that part of it was dark.
Right.
And then it got lighter and lighter and lighter. That's as your organic matter goes away.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
So here it's just your topsoil is tiny. Your subsoil isn't a whole lot bigger. And the terrible stuff that won't grow anything is close to the top.
Wow.
So it's just hard. The other funny thing that happened was our first class, we had a lesson in sexual harassment. And I thought, oh my God, I've had to go through this every year. You know, as a manager, you go through it every year what not to say and what not to ask and what not to do and all this stuff. Turned out the focus of this was, since we're unpaid volunteers, we're at like the bottom of the food chain. This was all how to recognize that you're being harassed and then what to do about it.
That was a
whole new perspective.
I love it. Well, this has been so much fun. We haven't gone through everything we were talking about, but anything else that you want to add before we...
This has just been a lot of fun.
It has been.
You asked really good questions. I appreciated that you gave me the questions ahead of time.
I think it thinking about them helps. Definitely.
Right. One of them that we didn't get to was the sort of what are my long-term goals for the future.
Well, yeah, I was just going to say that.
And I realized as I was doing this, I actually don't really have any, you know. My sort of philosophy of life is you just need to do what makes you happy.
Well, I think that's a good philosophy.
You know, I think in the short term, I need to get back to good health. All I've been doing is eating, sleeping, reading, eating, watching television, eating with an occasional, Jack Daniels to keep me happy. I'm worried that by the time I'm done with this, all that's going to fit is my bathrobe. So I need to get over all this cancer treatment and then get back to what I was doing before, which was going to the gym 3 days a week and taking a walk every day. And
well, so hopefully the end's in sight on the cancer treatment, right?
It is. I have... 2.5 more weeks.
Oh,
I was going to say 3, but it's 2.5 more weeks of radiation treatments. And then it takes about a week and a half after, it takes 5 days for the treatment,
the side effects
to quit accumulating.
Right.
They're actually killing your cancer cells and damaging your regular cells.
Ah.
And since cancer cells are such voracious eaters, if you keep bombarding them with radiation, eventually they die.
Right.
Because they're so genetically programmed to replicate themselves.
Okay, right.
Whereas your normal cells would just say, well, this is not a very hospitable environment now. I guess I'll wait to reproduce until a little later.
Right.
So it takes at least 5 days after each treatment for the cells to to respond and die and all that. Yeah, so by early November, I'll be done with my treatments and all the side effects should be gone.
Wonderful. Hallelujah.
Indeed.
Well, thank you so much for doing this. I really, really appreciate it. We could talk forever because you have a lot of interesting things to say.
We do talk a lot.
This is true.
Thank you.
That ends this edition of the Marian Vermeersen Podcast. I really enjoyed our conversation, and I'd like to thank Linda for agreeing to let me interview her. She's an amazing and interesting person. You can check out the show notes for this episode at marianvermeersen.blogs.com/mv-podcast. You can use iTunes to subscribe to the podcast, and I would really appreciate it if you'd write a review and rate the podcast in iTunes. Thanks for listening.